Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls.
Now, Katie, there's been a bit of a change in the climate around anti-Semitism in the past 24 hours in the Labour Party after a recording was published of one of the NEC members talking about something that he claimed he hadn't said.
Yes, so Labour's latest anti-Semitism row has gone from very bad to awful, probably, in the past 24 hours. There are reports, I think, over the past week that at NEC meeting, Pete Wilsman, who sits on the Labour NEC, had made comments basically dismissing lots of claims of anti-Semitism as either they were overplayed. And at the time, he seemed to issue a bit of a denial, non-denial, but it all moved on. Now what's happened is the recording has been leaked from that meeting. And he says things like, some of these critics within the Jewish community are Trump supporters, so that's why. And also suggests that the anti-Semitism problem is basically fabricated. He hasn't seen any cases for that, which is quite bizarre given that this person is involved with this disputes panel. So you would think that they would see quite a lot of at least alleged cases of anti-Semitism. This is set off everyone again. Obviously it comes after Margaret Hodge has had an investigation into her, and you've also had Ian Austin have an investigation into him. So I think it all adds up, and then as things stand, there isn't an investigation into this man. So you can join the dots as you see fit.
James, the supporters of this particular slate for the NEC elections, such as Owen Jones, who've rather changed their tune on the matter since this recording was released. Do you think it's coordinated, the response that we're seeing from Owen Jones, Aaron Bastani and other key members of the Labour left?
I mean, they were very quick this morning to come out and put distance. I mean, there are two things here. One is, he said this in an NEC meeting. No one seems to have upbraided him at the time. None of the senior Labour people who were there seem to have said, hang on a second.
I think he was asked to sit down, wasn't he? But it's not exactly a sort of
But the point in a way is, you could have abandoned the slate at that point. That didn't happen. But I think that also shows something about the lack of trust in the Labour Party right now, that people are taping NEC meetings and leaking them. That, I think, shows you the level of, whichever way you slice it, that does not suggest a party that is happy with itself when people are going to such extreme measures to deal with this. I also think there's a third point here, which is, how come this guy, as Katie said, has not been investigated? If this Labour code is meant to deal with anti-Semitism, there's surely a prima facie case for investigating this person. To suggest that all the social media stuff has been fabricated strikes me as a kind of fairly classic conspiracy theory. And so I think that is the next issue here, which is, why is there not an investigation here? And that also suggests that this code is not as strong as some of its defenders say. And I think, again, we come back to this essential point, which is the strength of feeling in the Jewish community about this, right? The Labour Party's refusal to adopt the full IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. This isn't an accident anymore. This is now quite a clearly deliberate act of policy. It's not that they thought that they could tweak it and come up with something better. It is quite clear that what the tweaks and the changes they've made do not satisfy the Jewish community in its whole gamut. This isn't about conservative Jews or Orthodox Jews being unhappy. This is the entire gamut of Jewish opinion in this country is not happy about this, in a community that normally very rarely agrees on anything. And I think the fact that they will still not do this, but they are prepared to carry on expending political capital on this issue, demonstrates how important it is to them. And I think we now need to ask questions about that. And I mean, that takes you back to the whole question about Jeremy Corbyn's fundamentally anti-Western worldview.
Katie, we've had reports also that John McDonnell has been taking a rather different line and has been appealing to Jeremy Corbyn that the investigation into Margaret Hodge in particular is actually dropped so as to draw a line under that particular route. Do you think that he'll win out on this, or do you think that Corbyn is so determined and those around Corbyn are so determined to try to use this as a route to weed out some of Corbyn's most vocal opponents like Hodge, like Ian Austin, that Corbyn will continue on this line?
I think it seems unlikely. I mean, it also depends on how hard John McDonnell is pushing. I mean,
or whether he's just telling the media that he's pushing.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't do his own, you know, ambitions much harm to see seen as a moderating force, if you could ever really call him, you know, the moderate force. But we have got to where we are, and it does seem that maybe just now he's having thoughts that maybe it's not quite enough. So I don't really see it changing the leader's office course on this, if it is even going that way. I think it does seem that these views are very entrenched. I think that also, if you're looking at party pressure, even public pressure, probably wouldn't be where we are right now.
I think it's a fascinating question about this John McDonnell thing, there, because if you think about the recent tensions between Jeremy Corbyn and, you know, the PLP, they aren't coming over domestic economic issues. However radical the Corbynite agenda is on that, there seems to be a kind of view that that is settled. They've come over things like Novichok, Russia and Salisbury and anti-Semitism. And what is interesting, in all these cases, John McDonnell's instinct seems to be kind of concede and move on. So he wants to say on Russia, we won't go on Russia today anymore. Jeremy Corbyn's office comes out and says, no, there isn't going to be any blanket bar on people appearing on Russia today. On the anti-Semitism scandal, John McDonnell saying, no, let's not investigate Margaret Hodge, that's just going to cause trouble. Jeremy Corbyn's office kind of won't pull the investigation. I think this is revealing in a way, because it is this dishonour that, in a way, if they just wanted to concentrate on the domestic economic agenda of Corbynism, I think that they now have sufficient control over the Labour Party to do that, to go into the next election offering a kind of fully Corbynite economic offering without actually prompting a breakaway party or mass resignations. But it is this desire not to give up on the other stuff, which I think is so central to Jeremy Corbyn's worldview, that is endangering all of the domestic elements of the Corbyn project.
Now, Katie, you've been writing about another row within Labour, which is the deselection votes against Kate Hoey and Frank Field. How do you think the leadership views this?
I don't think it's their first and foremost problem at the moment. I think the thing is, Jeremy Corbyn is more Eurosceptic than most people in the Labour Party. Always has been. Tries to, you know, gloss over it a bit now. I think in general, a leader's office will be more sympathetic to the views of people like Kate Hoey and Frank Field than the majority of the parliamentary Labour Party are. That said, the reason that there's been such a backlash between these MPs that rebelled on the customs union amendment is that not only did they annoy the pro-EU MPs and members who saw it as a chance to soften Brexit, perhaps even get close to stopping it, they really annoyed all the Corbynista MPs and Momentum supporters, because they really saw this as a point that if Theresa May had lost that crucial vote, you could have perhaps had an early election. And even if you didn't even get there, because obviously you do have the Fixed Term Parliament Act when it works, it would have made things very difficult and very, very choppy for the Conservatives, more than they even are now. So I think that's why you have this two-pronged anger about these MPs. So you've seen Kate Hoey and Frank Field both lose confidence motions in their local parties. And that doesn't mean necessarily that anything will happen. It does mean that you can try and bring about the trigger ballot. And at the moment, I do think it's interesting because you have, you know, senior figures Momentum saying these people need to go or they can't be chosen for re-selection and things like that. And you haven't heard that much noise from the Labour moderates, which is odd, because usually when we hear about trigger ballots and deselection, there's a lot of noise and a lot of outrage from, you know, these MPs. And I think they've got to be a bit careful here, because although they don't, might not feel particularly sympathies to someone like Kate Hoey, who has always really been at loggerheads to their views on Europe, if they do let this go and if somehow a trigger ballot is brought about, that does set a precedent. So I think if, you know, in a few months down the line, they say, oh, actually, we think we should do the same thing here for the reason that this MP is not loyal enough to Jeremy Corbyn, I think it would be hard to say they had a leg to stand on if this does happen.
And James, it's not as though that isn't a live issue in itself. We have Chris Williamson doing his Democracy Roadshow, which seems to be a sort of campaign around the country for the deselection of people he doesn't like.
Yes, although I think Chris Williamson, I mean, I think his response to the scandal this morning is to say that he's putting this guy at the top of his slate, which is just remarkable. I mean, it is one of these things that, you know, sometimes you're kind of, your jaw drops. He seems to regard this as a kind of positive reason to vote for him almost. As Katie said, there is a question here, which is, if you basically say, right, deviating from the party line on Brexit justifies your deselection, then why is Brexit different from other issues? You know, why are Labour MPs, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, who criticised Jeremy Corbyn over Russia and Salisbury? Why is that different? I think that is the question. I think, as Katie said, the problem they've got themselves into is they've fallen foul of two separate groups. They've fallen foul of a kind of, you know, leadership loyalists who want a general election as soon as possible, and they've fallen foul of those people who come to view Labour as a kind of inherently pro-EU party.
Now, staying on the topic of Brexit, but moving on to the government's problems with Brexit, we have a problem today over the potential for a deal with the City of London or not.
Yeah, so there's a few different reports which I think send different signals. I mean, the FT suggests that Michelle Barnier is actually now quite fond of the UK's plan for the city, which would see services stay out of the single market. But I think the reason he might like this is because he now thinks that the EU would have more control than the UK. But meanwhile, you have, I think the reports that are getting even more excited, is this tit for tat threat, which is basically that UK negotiators have said, if you do make things difficult for us, if you don't guarantee us certain rights, if we don't get the access we want, we can do that back to you. And we can restrict all these kind of funds and things that you have here. So I think what's interesting is this is probably, I would say, when Brexiteers call for, like, you know, no deal preparations or, you know, tougher negotiating line, I think what they want to see is not talking about stockpiling food, but pointing out this is a two-way process and, you know, there are consequences for both sides when one decides to not be helpful. So I think some will be quite happy to have read those reports.
And James, we've got Jeremy Hunt doing his first round of foreign visits. We obviously had the Chinese-Japanese wife gaffe yesterday. Today he's in Paris.
Yeah, so he is trying to make the case. He's making the same message, taking the same message to Paris that he took to Berlin, basically, which is if there isn't a deal, the winner from that, the geopolitical winner from that, he says, will be kind of Vladimir Putin. I think on what Katie was saying about the Sisi, I think this is one of the cases of actually the UK negotiating in the right way for once, which is if you're going to get a deal, you need to make clear the consequences to both sides of there not being an agreement. And I think you can see in the softening of Barnier's language on the FT, because I don't think the UK proposal has changed at all. Even those close to Barnier seem to be saying, oh, he misunderstood the proposal originally. I think it does demonstrate that when the UK is prepared to spell out the consequences for both sides of not getting a deal, the Commission basically takes a slightly less hard line because it knows there are limits on what it can do because of what the member states will do. Now, what you've got Jeremy Hunt trying to do is he's trying to kind of get the member states to lean on the Commission to take a more pragmatic approach. He's trying to say, look, come on, you guys have got to work with Chequers. If you don't work with Chequers, then we won't get that. And I think now everything turns on what happens in Salzburg in September when Theresa May has this opportunity to pitch her plan directly to the EU heads of government. You know, one of the number 10's great frustrations have been, oh, the member states are, we can't get to the member states, the Commission are not presenting our proposals to them fairly. This is her chance to sell them on her idea. I personally suspect that while she will find them more understanding of her political situation and mildly more pragmatic than the Commission, I don't think she's going to turn up at Salzburg in September and say, here's Chequers, and they'll say, oh, that sounds great, let's just do that.
Finally, Katie, we have a report from the International Development Committee on the sexual abuse and exploitation in Oxfam, which was published today, and it accused the aid sector of complacency verging on complicity over this matter.
It's a damning report. They say that sexual exploitation is endemic in the aid sector and that the Oxfam scandal is just the tip of the iceberg, which I think obviously begs the question of what people are going to do about it and how a charity is going to respond.
I think the issue here is that these charities are going to fall into this kind of classic trap. They think they are doing good. So when they hear about a member of their staff doing something wrong, their instinct is to protect their funding streams. So if we basically publicly sack this person and say why we sacked them, that might lead to donations both from private individuals and from governments and multinational organisations to dry up, and that would end up hurting more people. So it's therefore kind of morally acceptable to cover it up. And that is always the problem in these kind of cases. I also think it's the other problem you've got is you have in this sphere, you have obvious massive power imbalances. If someone has food and clean water in a place where people don't have food and clean water, if they are ending up in a relationship with someone, there are obviously question marks about whether with that power dynamic at play, that relationship can ever be properly consensual.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And for a limited time, you can try a month of The Spectator online for free in our summer sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/summer to start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.